This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the most responsible podcast in the business. My name is Matt Wolf, and I'll be your host. Our topic for this episode is responsibility for player behaviors. And with me this time are two designers who are completely responsible for their own opinions. First up is Daniel Solis. Hey, Daniel.
Hello, hello.
Sleep deprived and everything, but glad to be here, I hope.
Yep.
And also with us is Drew Hicks. Hey, Drew.
Howdy.
Perhaps not sleep deprived, but also happy to be here. All right.
Always sleep deprived.
All right, let's go into our first segment here is the What's in the Oven segment. So, Drew, what you been working on?
Cool. So, if you have been listening to the podcast for a little bit, you'll know I was working on a dexterity game called alternately Out on a Limb or Oolong or something like that. And I've reworked that pretty significantly, involving some doodads from a couple off-the-shelf dexterity games to a game where players are waiters stacking food on trays, trying to be able to take as much food, as many orders out to tables at once as they can, which is basically entirely inspired by the pun name Tall Order. So, yeah, it's great. It's super great. So that definitely exists. I'm hoping to move forward with that pretty quick because I really like where it's headed. So,
Tall Order, you and your pun titles.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. I don't know how you can have that kind of no one else on the, it's audio, so no one can see your face, but if they could, they'd know how wrong you were about your opinion about that title.
All right, Daniel, what you been working on?
I am about to release my first self-published game in quite a while.
Cool.
It's going to be Curse You, Robin Hood, which has been in development and kind of like design phase for a little bit, and it's been pretty solid the past few months. And I decided this year, since I've sold a couple games to publishers already, I decided that I should just get back to self-publishing again, just to kind of get my output out there and get things done, which was the whole reason I decided to self-publish in the first place all those years ago. So this is coinciding with DriveThruCard's new feature, Tuck Boxes. Amazing. Woo! Tuck Boxes. So I'll be designing a tuck box with this game, still waiting on some templates and stuff, hoping to get it done by the end of September, crossing fingers, but I'll keep everyone updated on how that's going on my Twitter feed.
Very cool.
Cool.
Anything else you guys want to mention before we move on to our main topic?
I would like to mention one real quick plug for SPX, the Small Press Expo in Bethesda, Maryland. It is a small comics convention focused on independent comics creators, and it is a fantastic place to find art talent, freelancers, illustrators, anyone who's working in visual arts. If you're a publisher, seek out new talent there, because everyone there is really cool, amazing aesthetics, and very, very talented people, and very cool people. And it's just great. I love it. It was good.
That after convention high, I see.
A little bit. A little punchy.
Yeah. All right. So let's go into our main topic here, which is responsibility for player behaviors. And what the overall question is that we're trying to answer is, how responsible is the designer for player behavior in their games? And I think this is a really interesting question. This is one that Drew came up with for the topic. And Drew, is there any particular reason why you want to talk about this one, or anything that really appeals to you about this topic?
Well, the main reason I wanted to talk about it is that at the meetings, we'd sort of bumped up against it a couple of times, talking about how very open-ended games that allow players to do a whole lot of different things within their systems can sometimes foster some negative behaviors that can make the game less fun for some groups. So the sort of core of it was how much reward is there in those systems, and then how much penalty or how much harm can you do to your game by not taking responsibility for the behavior that those systems allow. So, I mean, we'll get into a couple of the specific questions a little bit later, but we just kept talking about it and having really engaging discussions about it at the meeting. So I thought it would be a pretty cool podcast topic. And also I've been screaming into the Twitter void about it recently as well. So,
all right. Yeah, I agree that it is a really interesting topic. And I think it's something that I'll say up front that I don't know that there's like a right answer, but I do think there's probably
those are the best questions.
Well, yeah, that is true. I think there's probably a spectrum in which is probably where you want to try to get your design in, and hopefully we'll be able to try to identify that. So let's kind of start with what we think is probably an easy question here, and that is, who is more responsible for preventing players from cheating in a game? Is it the players and the group that is playing the game themselves, or is it the designer? And what do you think, Daniel?
In this one, I gotta say, it falls to the players to police each other. The designer can't be expected to account for the player behavior at this level for everybody who's playing the game at any time, forever, as long as the game exists. This is something that players have to watch out for each other.
All right, so Drew, what do you think? Do you agree with Daniel, or do you have something different?
So, yeah, in general, I think this is a pretty solid, the players are responsible for it. But the reason I think it's an interesting question, there's basically two reasons. First is that I have seen criticism of games with sort of hidden things that are manipulated behind a screen, or games with like a completely hidden element like Scotland Yard or Escape from the Aliens in Outer Space, these types of things, where a player could cheat and it wouldn't be detected for a long time. And or in Roll for the Galaxy, a player could cheat and it would never be detected. And I've seen those things sort of brought up as criticisms of those games, something that makes those games weaker because you aren't able to figure out what players are doing. The second reason is because in Jinx, which is a cooperative party game that I'm designing, there are a couple of cases where I've left it entirely up to the players not to cheat. In essence, when something that they're naming is not a member of the category, it's up to the group of players to say, okay, that was a bad answer, that was wrong. And even though it's a cooperative game, that's sort of an interesting area because since it's cooperative, if the group decides to do that, maybe that's just how they're playing, or maybe the game should be stricter about it and try to come up with some criteria by which that can be kind of more easily judged as right or wrong. So that's kind of why I thought it was interesting. But yeah, in general, I don't think it's reasonable to say that a game that's easy to cheat at is, and that's necessarily the designer's fault, or that makes the game worse.
Yeah, I think Roll for the Galaxy.
Yeah,
I think that one is, that's an interesting one. I could see how someone could just roll their dice and then change a die face to whatever they're actually wanting. But boy, that really seems like you're just playing with a person who's a turd. Why are they playing games with people? Are they really that competitive that they have to cheat at a, at a tabletop game? I don't know. Maybe they are. But yeah, I mean, if you would find out someone's doing that, then, you know, you never play a game with that person again.
Sure.
If I could, I mean, we're presenting this situation as if it's a negative always, that cheaters are always doing it for their own good and at the expense of the other players, and certainly at the expense of fun, in essence, breaking the magic circle, to use the very, very sure. jargony term.
Yeah.
But there are situations coming from the role-playing game side of things. Mm. There's a classic history of dungeon masters and GMs fudging die rolls when it seems to fit the narrative better or fit the mood of the game, to not have these situations where the dice would tell them that something is going to happen that changes the flow of the narrative that in a way that they don't like or that they don't think is natural. Or in a co-op game where people house rule certain things to make the game a little bit easier or perhaps even a little bit harder. Or sometimes co-op games where they just keep on playing even though they've technically lost because they want to see how it would have ended had they made it to that last turn. These are all in their own ways cheating, and the designer has no control over that technically. But in role-playing game circles, there has been a lot of discussion about whether a designer is at fault if a group has to cheat in order to continue playing the game as the spirit of the game it instructs them to do.
You're right that we are framing it as like a negative thing. But I think because mainly we are talking about like a competitive, you know, board, card, dice game. When you talk about a co-op game or if you talk about an RPG, to me that feels a little bit different. And like in your example of the co-op game, I don't know, like if you were playing Pandemic and, you know, you would get an outbreak and that's actually going to cause you to lose, but you wanted to like kind of check the deck to see, okay, what were the next couple cards going to be? How would we have done? I don't know. Like to me, that feels like you're right, like technically that's cheating, but it feels like almost a separate category or a type of cheating. Like there it's okay, because like the group is saying, let's just see what would have happened, and let's have, you know, we're kind of making our own fun. So I guess for a competitive tabletop game, I think we're in kind of agreement that the designer really can't and probably shouldn't worry too much about cheating. Is that accurate?
Sure. I've got one case that might be tangential. In both of the things that I brought up as examples, Roll for the Galaxy and like deduction hidden movement games.
Yeah.
We were talking about players cheating intentionally and that being easy to do, and that's certainly true. But in Roll for the Galaxy especially, and also in a lot of kind of deduction games, it's also easy to cheat, to do something wrong that you wouldn't detect, right? So in Roll for the Galaxy, you roll the dice behind the screen, and there's some abilities that let you move dice, or you can place one dice on the console at regardless of what face it is. Different things like that, and there's a lot of moving parts there, and it's relatively easy to make a mistake, and because you're doing it all behind your screen, it's not possible, or, well, it's possible, but not very easy at all for someone to recreate what happened behind your screen. And similarly, in some of those hidden movement games, if you accidentally say that you're not one space away from somewhere when you actually are, or vice versa, you can really screw up the game state in a way that benefits you, in a way that kind of can't be traced back. And that's where I think the criticism starts to have a little bit of merit, because the game being easy to foul up in those ways is certainly something that could be, if not the fault of, it's certainly like a characteristic of those kinds of designs, with those so much open stuff going on out of view of the players.
So I think that's a really interesting point, but I think once again, like at least in my mind, that's not necessarily in the same bucket as cheating, although I guess like technically it would be cheating. Like for me, I would see that as almost a factor of the brittleness of the design. And in terms of like, if a player would, you know, accidentally screw something up, what is the impact of that on the game? And I'll give you an example of Avalanche at Yeti Mountain. This is something that we found out after it got out into the wild, but players were sometimes rocket jumping on the very first turn of the game, which you can't do. You have to be on a card in order to rocket jump. And the rules, and this is my fault, they don't explicitly say that you can't do that. But if you kind of like take A to B to C, you understand that you can't do that, because, you know, it talks about you have to match a color to a color. And, you know, if you're not on a card,
to the card that you're on.
Right.
Which if you're at the start of the game, you're on the table, right?
Right, right. But, you know, people have, you know, made that mistake, and that actually kind of makes the game unplayable if you do that. And because that's something I never even thought about, that design is way more brittle than it should be. So if I was going to go back and like if we were going to do like a second edition or something, I would try to figure out how to fix that to make the design less brittle. So if someone would rocket jump off the first turn of the game, it would not lead to such a degenerative state in the game. So what you're describing with like Roll for the Galaxy, with someone like doing something behind their player screen that they shouldn't have been able to do, I feel like for the most part, that's probably not really kind of breaking the game. It's not making it too degenerative, but it is allowing a player to do something that they shouldn't have been able to do. But like, I guess that feels like that design isn't as brittle as, or, you know, it's not so brittle that it would break the game. And yeah, I don't know. Do you guys feel like that is on the designer to try to make sure that their game is not brittle, or at least has enough elasticity that it can survive mistakes like that? Or is it up to the players to, you know, very clearly follow the rules and play it the way it's supposed to be?
I look at it like a warranty that you're making a product, and you're making a chair. You're making that chair as best as you can make it. You're pretty sure that it's not gonna just fall out from most people who sit on it, and that people are going to sit on it in the way that you expect them to sit on it. They're not gonna be like jumping up and down on it or whatever. So within the bounds of the warranty, yes, a designer is responsible for making sure the game is not going to fall apart underneath the players. But if the players start doing things either without your like accidental things that you didn't expect them to do, much like you're describing, perhaps you didn't anticipate that, and yes, perhaps you could in later editions and later revisions update that chair and put a patch on that chair to make sure that it can handle the way people are using it now in real life once you've seen it out in the wild. But until that time, I mean, there's only so much that you can do. And I look at this as another example. Magic the Gathering or any other competitive card game, there are vast resources available for the design and development of those games, and yet still the vast majority of time they spend in competitive scenes is with volunteer judges who have to look up rulings or make up rulings on the spot just to keep the game going because the players have found some odd edge case that the designers and developers, even with all the resources, even they couldn't spot. Are we at fault as designers when those situations arise? Maybe I'm biased, but I would say no.
Hmm. What do you think, Drew?
So I think generally I'm on board with that. I think deduction games are kind of a special case where the entire thing can be derailed if a mistake is easy to make. I think an example of a game that actually does do something mechanically to try to address that is PI. Have either of you played that game?
No.
So in PI, most deduction games you have you asking some question and then recording the answer somehow and using that record of all of the answers to figure out something towards the end of it. And obviously in a lot of those games, if an incorrect answer is ever given, it can really, really foul up what's happening. And that's a common, maybe not criticism, but a common issue in those types of games. PI does actually deal with it a little bit mechanically by having your answer be something that's a physical object that's placed in a physical location on the board, and it's in your color. And so there's a lot of information available to everybody about what answer you gave and when. So it's really possible for people to, you know, trace back. That's the answer that you gave. I didn't record it wrong. You can kind of figure out what thing happened. And maybe it doesn't make a mistake. It makes a mistake less likely by reducing the number of times it's kind of transcribed, I guess. So I give the answer. I put a thing on the board. There's only one place an error could have been made. Whereas if you ask me a question and I could, you know, misinterpret the question, I could give an answer and then you write the answer down somewhere. There's like three places that the error could be made. And if it's open information, each player could make a mistake. So it just reduces the number of times that the message gets transmitted, kind of, and kind of reduces the opportunity for those things. So I think that's a case where a game did actually try to address this. But yeah, and I think that was a valiant effort on the designer's part there.
That was Martin Wallace, but, isn't it?
Yeah. But in cases outside from that, I feel like, you know, players actually misunderstanding the rules, again, that's something like the warranty analogy is great. If players use the system according to the, you know, the terms of use or whatever, it will work. And if they do something that's outside of that, that's actually not part of the rules, then maybe it's not your responsibility. The only gray areas I can see are areas where a system is so convoluted, like maybe there's a lot of upkeep or something like that, where it's just extremely easy to make a mistake. And then I think it's always beneficial for the designer or for the publisher, I guess, in some cases, producing components to come up with some way of making those mistakes harder, right? Making it more difficult to make those types of mistakes in upkeep or bookkeeping or anything like that.
Yeah,
because like fiddliness, right? That's kind of what we're getting at there. A game is extremely fiddly; a lot of pieces to move around. That's a common criticism as well, and I do think reducing that's admirable. So,
I'll have to play PI because that I really like deduction games, and now I'm curious to see, you know, what he did to try to address that issue of you wrote something down like, you know, you were Jack in letters from Whitechapel, and oh, you weren't really in that spot. You couldn't have gotten there. We should have caught you three turns ago. So yeah, we really win, but it's not satisfying.
Yeah, that's always awful.
Yeah, it is.
One last little note on this topic. I'm trying to remember the game where the designer intentionally allowed for you to cheat if you could get away with it.
Cheaty mages,
you can do it,
right?
At Munchkin.
Cheaty Mages, like the theme of it is cheating, but I think Illuminati was the game where you were allowed to cheat, like sneaking money away or doing whatever. I think it was Illuminati, but I could be wrong about that. But and then the viewers are going to tell us whether I'm wrong here. But that's another way to do it. I mean, you could, instead of an abstinence only mode, you could say the players are going to cheat, and I will actively encourage it, and it'll just be part of the gameplay experience.
Oh boy. That's the last question. That's super cool because that's the like way, way, way opposite end of the spectrum of these.
You know, outside some edge cases, you know, maybe like co-ops or you know, RPGs, I can certainly see, you know, some sort of ancillary similar thing to cheating, but not necessarily cheating. Like, it seems like for the most part, you know, I think we're pretty much in agreement when you're talking about competitive games that trying to prevent cheating is much more on the group than it is on the designers, and it's more about trying to prevent the design being too brittle for mistakes. And but I mean, of course, if there's something that you can change in the game that will do something that would address like maybe some part of the game where you could cheat and it also makes the game better, then of course you would want to do that. Yeah, I think this one is usually going to be on the players. So the next one here, who's more responsible for preventing analysis paralysis or, you know, just kind of players playing very, I guess, not necessarily very slowly, but too slowly for whatever the game is? You know, is that more on the designer or is that more on players? Drew, what do you think?
This one's a lot harder, and the results of the, you know, the informal Twitter research that I was doing kind of bear that out, because we're about actually exactly 50-50 as of this exact instant with 78 votes. So I think that there are a couple factors at play here, but largely the game designer is actually responsible for this one. I've seen a lot of criticism saying that, you know, just tell that player to play faster and give them the turtle, the ceramic turtle figurine or whatever random object you're passing around. But typically what this is a case where if the game, to play the game optimally, to actually make the right move, requires examining a bunch of options, legitimately requires to examining all those options, that's the game designer's fault. Now, there are cases where there's a player that doesn't need to examine all of the options, because even though there are 500 things you could do, only two of them currently matter. And so I think that they're on a case-by-case basis, it could be the player's responsibility. But the game designer should, in their game, make sure to avoid those kinds of circumstances where there's a big branching decision tree that has a bunch of relatively equal options, and picking out the closest or best one is going to be difficult.
All right. How about you, Daniel? What do you think? Designer or players?
I'm going to be the oddball and say it's the responsibility of marketing.
Oh.
That.
I'm sorry, sir, but that was not an option in the poll.
I know. This is my Gordian knot solution here. I would say partly yes. Players need to understand when they are the slowest decision maker at the table. At the same time, players should also recognize when a game offers a lot of decisions and there's a big decision tree and every option you have available to you has a number of consequences to it that branch off into infinity. And if a player knows that they are a slow decision maker and they are in fact playing a game with a lot of decisions to it, then when they sit at the table, then they are accepting the possibility that they are going to be the AP player in that group. And they should inform the other players of that fact, that I am in fact an AP player. I have analysis paralysis. I may slow the game down. I don't think that's a bad thing to admit up front before you sit at the table even. And there's no shame in that. As long as everybody is on board with it when you enter that gameplay experience, then everybody's cool. But if you are maybe kind of doubting yourself, or maybe believe yourself to be a faster player, or you find yourself apologizing for how long you're taking frequently, perhaps then you should kind of check yourself and understand that maybe this game is not the right game to play with this particular group, or for you to play with someone else, or with that number of players. There's a lot of variables there. So that's on the player's task list. But where I would say that marketing and publishing and take the greater role is promising a gameplay experience to those players that is accurate, that if the marketing and the presentation of that game really emphasizes, yes, this is going to be a thinky game that you have to really analyze. There's going to be some downtime. If you're cool with that, great. This is the game for you. Don't present that game as if it's a fast, rip-roaring, really quick, like a very different type of experience. Just don't promise that. And then you won't get the players who expect this particular experience, A, to get experience B. I think that's where the marketing is really setting the expectations here for those players, and where there's so much mismatch between what people sit down at a table hoping to play and what they actually get at the end of it 2 hours later when they didn't expect to take that long.
Hmm. So you're saying if you had like a Raving Rabbids board game and it's like a 2.5 hour, like really heavy resource management game Like, that's a... So you would say, like, that's probably the wrong theme for that kind of thing, because that's going to attract the players who would totally be into, like, a light, kind of silly game.
Yes, I say this at having made this mistake. Like, I'm not calling anybody out. I have made that mistake. I have given some of my card games cute and light themes, and the mechanics of therein were much more thinky and heavy than people who were attracted to that theme were expecting or even wanted. So I'm calling myself out this one.
What's an example of one where you did that?
Nine Lives was a cute little cat card game where you're trying to rescue cats who have gone missing and return them to the shelter without getting too many scratches. So that was the pitch, and the resulting game, I didn't refine it enough. There were too many set collection elements, and as a result, every card you took interacted with a number of different set collection elements. And on top of that, every card also had different actions that you could associate with it. There was a lot of decisions happening there, and it slowed the game down for those who were expecting something that was a lot lighter and easier to get right off the bat.
I got another example. I'll call someone else out because. And I love this game, so this is not a criticism. It's a criticism. It's a criticism of the game. It's really good. The game Sapiens, published by Yellow, I think. I don't know the designer's name off the top of my head, unfortunately. But it's a kind of Stone Age-themed domino-looking game where you place these little two-sided tiles down on the board, and you're kind of trying to connect stuff together. And it seems really, really simple rule set-wise. You're just kind of connecting tiles. It looks like it'd be a really good gateway game. The problem is, it's really important when you're playing the game to know the distribution of the dominoes, so you know there's a couple of each pairing, and whenever you place something on the board, it means that the spaces directly around that now cannot have certain of those dominoes placed in them. And you have an extremely limited space, and if you're not able to place a domino, you get beat up really bad. So you need to be thinking about all that stuff all the time. The resulting game is not only kind of a brain burner, but it's also really mean. There's a lot of very rude things you can do to your other players and lock them out of the tiles that they actually really need. So I like that game a lot, but the theme kind of doesn't carry that through. And if you come into that game expecting like a gateway, you know, if I went into that game, a similar kind of game is like Lanterns. Lanterns is compared to Dominoes a lot, right? But it doesn't, it can be mean and confrontational, but in a really different way. So going into one of those experiences expecting the other one, well, it caused a lot of problems. So I think I'm with you on marketing, right? If I present a game as a extremely strategic brain burner, people are less likely to go into it and complain about how hard the decisions were and how long it took them to make one than if I present it as, you know, there's little animals on these tiles. So, yeah.
Yeah, we're actually coming – Drew and I are working on this situation right now with sure. a tile game that we have. It's pretty abstract in its current state, and there's definitely a lot of decisions that are – involved with every choice you make, and if you're playing with four players, and there can be a couple minutes of downtime while everyone else is kind of making their decision on their turn. Granted, in our game, the decision space gradually shrinks as the game progresses, which helps significantly if you can engineer your game that way. And so while the first turns have a whole universe of choices available to you that can seem to branch out into infinity, as the game continues, those decisions and options reduce gradually until you're down to just like really to one choice. That can feel a little anticlimactic, and so we're tailoring that little tweaks here and there. It's a thing we have to deal with. We have to make sure that we're presenting that game in a way with a theme, with a name even, that is letting players know this is the experience you're in for, and if you're into that, you're going to have a great time. But don't go in here expecting a comedy game.
Museum Simulator 2000.
Yeah, we don't want to, like, that's the thing. We also don't want to make it sound boring. Because
Simulator implies a comedy game anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Actually, yeah.
You're right. Yeah. Now it's retro. So it's funny now. I think you guys both brought up really, really good points. And Daniel, I totally agree that marketing needs to be right for the game to give the right you know, expectations of what a player is going to expect going into the game. And just kind of like that level set is super important. And even not necessarily just in terms of the AP, but just in terms of what experience you're going to be expecting. We've all had experiences where we've gone to play something and it's like, oh, that is not at all what I was expecting. Like, I think the most recent one I can think of is playing Scythe. Like, you know, it's built as a 4X game. That's like, it's like a 2.5X game. So you go into it and you're just like, okay, this is not at all what my preconceived notions were. I think they're doing a disservice calling that a 4X game, but that's a different topic. But I do think, though, and I think what you said earlier about like not having a whole bunch of choices that are effectively equal is also a really, you know, important thing. If you have like two or three, that's okay. And that's where those meaty decisions come from. But if you have like eight and it's like, I could choose any of these eight and it's really difficult to tell the difference between them, I think that is on the designer. You know, so I think there is, once again, there's a spectrum between the two ends where, you know, you can't use, well, I'm not marketing this towards lighter gamers, so therefore I don't need to worry about AP. Like, I don't think that's the right mindset for a designer. And at the same time, they can't be, I want to have really deep, meaty decisions, and so I'm not going to aim it at the Munchkin crowd. Not to say people who like Munchkin couldn't also like a deep game, but that crowd generally is probably not going to gravitate towards, you know, something like Nippon or even, you know, Scythe or things like that. I think if I had to pick between designers and players, I think I would pick designers, that I think they are more responsible, but I definitely agree, like, it's not all on them, right? And the players do have to come into it a little bit with the correct, you know, level set and expectations.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think I'm with you.
Awesome. 1 point for me. Okay. We're keeping a score now. So the next question here, the next Twitter poll that Drew put up shortly before we recorded this episode is, who is more responsible for preventing, quote unquote, against the spirit play? And it would be like, you know, either like bash the winner or, you know, trying to game the system of the game in a way that's kind of not really in the spirit of the game. You know, is that on the designer or is that on the group and the players? And what do you think, Daniel?
This kind of goes back a little bit to what we were talking about with the cheating aspect of gameplay. And that in turn also ties back into the magic circle, have we talked about that on the podcast already?
We haven't really defined a magic circle. Do you want to give a quick definition?
Yeah, loosely, it's the agreement you come to with other players when you start to play a game that, one, the game matters, two, that you're all trying to achieve the objectives that the game has set out for you, and you're following the rules that the game has set out for you, more or less. And there's different definitions of this, and it's a fairly older concept in game design academia, but that's generally the idea. And now I think there's been some advances in that concept. I think that it doesn't just start at the table the moment you start to play the game. I think there's a meta circle around the gameplay experience where people, you know, talk about the game. They go to forums, they discuss best practices and strategies and that sort of thing. And in that sort of hazy liminal space, it's harder to say whether the spirit of the game is what one player thinks of it versus someone else. Like, in one player, they may view the game as an ultimately competitive, take that zero-sum experience where you use every resource available to you. Say, for example, in a competitive CCG, your budget. Like, you literally have more money than other players, and you're going to buy the best deck, and you're going to use the deck lists that other players have outlined, and you're not going to go into development and figuring out those decks on your own.
There's also an example in that realm of players like taking notes during games of what cards in their opponent's hands and decks that they've seen, and making sure not to let anyone see their deck list before the game. So these types of behaviors that, you know, some players with a different idea of what the game should be will like say, oh, that's cheap, or he's being a tryhard or something like that, right? But that's entirely within the scope of the game for that person. So the example that I was talking with Graham at Color Ninja on Twitter about something being classified as a game versus activity, and he brought up this idea of in Cards Against Humanity, if one player or set of players is deliberately trying to select cards based on the fact that they think the loser picked them, right? So I'm trying to pick whoever's behind so that I won't lose my lead, right? As something that kind of does something strange in that game, because somebody playing it with the objective of actually winning and getting the points is going to be doing really different stuff than someone playing it with the objective of I want to play this card because I think people will pick it because it's funny, and then I want to pick the funniest card from those that were suggested. And then you have kind of the same issue in maybe Dixit, but Dixit kind of mechanically puts a little bit of a damper on that with some of the mechanisms there, right? Like wanting some people to vote for you but not everybody, and by more sort of rigorously anonymizing the cards that are submitted than Cards Against Humanity does, where, you know, I've seen people playing Cards Against Humanity actually like take into account the order that the cards came out and like look at people's faces and try to pick which one was which I think is harder to do in Dixit, and I think that's intentional. I think it's designed to restrict that kind of thing.
So Daniel, you were explaining the magic circle, but you didn't get a chance to say what you think.
Oh,
you can't get off the hook that easy.
Oh, okay. So the question being whether a designer or a player is more responsible for maintaining the, call it the social decorum of the game?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to put it.
I suppose in this case, I would have to say it. I feel like I'm really sandbagging players in these questions, but. You know what? I'll play my own devil's advocate. I'll say it's the designer. I'll argue for the designer in this case. So there are things that a designer can do to enforce and mandate a sense of social decorum and social contract when players play this game. Sometimes it can be explicit. Like there's a TV trope called I think the Voice of God or something, where a movie director or a TV showrunner will explicitly state what the new canon is of this TV show or movie or comic book. And in that case, a game designer could explicitly say, this is not how you're supposed to play the game. I want you to play it this way. That's not the best way to do it, because their primary role should be in designing a system that reinforces the way they want it to actually play. And that's why that's where I think a designer really needs to step up. And if they want a game to be played in a particular way, they got to really make sure that every mechanic and every rule and choice in that game reinforces that type of behavior. If they want it to be a fun, silly game, put a timer in it. That's just, you know, offhand here. But if they want it to be more chaotic, if everybody is on the crazy train at all times, throw some dice in there, make it randomized. Don't put odd choices. If you do want it to be competitive and explicitly zero sum, present it that way. I guess this kind of goes back to promises and marketing and stuff, but design with that in mind. Know that your players are going to be hardcore competitive players, and accept that and cater to them and foster that behavior if you want, but don't go into it expecting any other behavior or wanting any other player behavior than what you're really designing for.
All right. How about you, Drew?
I also generally think that this is, if I'm going to have to pick more here, more the designer's responsibility than the players. I think that there's something to be said for the game group deciding that someone's playing the game very differently from them and maybe they don't want to play with that person. But it makes me wary of the sort of playing it wrong defense, or the game's not for everybody kind of defense, where someone can kind of, you know, brush aside some of these types of criticisms by saying the players just are entirely at fault because they're not respecting the voice of God enough, or they're not respecting the way that the game was intended to be played. I think in a case like Cards Against Humanity, where there's two kind of valid paths and they conflict with each other so harshly, that actually is sort of that's certainly a designer problem. Another example is, let me go to maybe Panic Station for this. So have either of you played Panic Station?
No, but I've heard infamous rants about this game.
So Panic Station is a game based on, I think maybe I talked about this one already once, but Panic Station is a game where it's based on sort of the thing. Players are inhabitants of a base. They are a player and an android, and somebody either at the start of the game or shortly into the game will become infected by the thing. And then their objective changes to be that they want to infect as many players as possible and defend their hive, while the other players are trying to find the hive and burn it with flamethrowers or something like that. The game works very, very well if players are playing it in the spirit of the game. They're saying, you know, we're all cooperative and we don't have any reason to think that we're not at the start. And we're going to try to work together by trading items to try to accomplish this goal as quickly as possible. And we're not going to sort of violate some of these assumptions that, you know, aside from this one person, the rest of us are on a team. But if players decide to play it in sort of an entirely solo way, like each player refuses to cooperate with anybody else at all from the beginning of the game, it's very difficult for the bad guys to win, and it's tedious but relatively easy for the good guys to win. So that's like the spirit of the game is it's got this like sort of tension, this almost role-playing aspect to it where you have to say, I wouldn't want to run off into the distance because then I would be killed. And the game has some ways of sort of enforcing that kind of thing, like you can spawn little monsters out there and different things like that. But once players are sort of mechanically mathing out the game, it doesn't work as well. So that's a case where designers responsible for where the two ways of playing the game conflict so harshly as that. But then you have some other cases where stuff we were talking about before, where players just kind of making dick moves and attacking people that aren't in the lead and things like that, that might not be in the spirit of the game. I guess a role-playing example is also pretty common, where the rest of the party is playing pretty seriously and then one player is the thief that's stealing everything from everyone, trying to disguise themselves as Hitman. Like, I put on the waiter's outfit, so now I should be recognized as the waiter, like kind of taking this kind of silly approach to it. In some of those cases, I think the game designer can't be entirely responsible. So
if we could pull out one small case study of this that I think is probably a good highlight of it, is hate drafting.
Ooh.
The term hate drafting being a thing that happens in a drafting game or any drafting experience where your choice to take a thing denies that choice to another player. And sometimes that taking that thing and making that choice is not beneficial to you, but you know it's beneficial to the other player and you know the other player would want it, and so you take it from them, even though it gives you no added benefit. It's a completely utilitarian choice to do so. There's a really good analysis of this by Richard Molina that is on the YouTube series Atomic Game Theory. Link to that in the show notes. But it's essentially this experience where you have no reason to take that card or that piece or that unit or module or what have you, but except that it helps someone else. Is it in the spirit of the game to deny that choice to your opponent, or is it more in the spirit of the game to only make choices that are beneficial to you? If you're, and there's a lot of ways you can view that choice from a utilitarian perspective and from a spiritual, I guess, perspective. And you have to decide as a designer, like, which choice are you presenting to your players, and what choices are they going to make, and how are they going to make those choices? If every other part of the game is all about utilitarianism, then they're going to make the choice that just makes the most sense, even if it doesn't make anything fun for them in that traditional sense.
Have you seen a lot of criticism of hate drafting and drafting games? I mean, apart from the video, I haven't seen the video that you talked about. So,
and that's the thing. I think it's a good case study because it is a relatively neutral experience. In most games, people accept that at a certain point, the choices available to you are not going to benefit you at all. And so in that case, yeah, it makes sense to hate draft because from among all the choices available, the better option is not to take something that's neutral to you, but in fact leads to something that denies your opponent an opportunity to do something that could harm you. It's the negation of harm rather than the addition of benefit in your case. And so in that case, I think it's an important case study because some people, I think most people, when they experience this, they see the benefits of it, and they also see how it kind of sucks to be on the other side of that. But they take it in stride because everybody's doing it, and that's where I think it's a useful case study for this.
I think kind of related to hate drafting would be in worker placement games when someone takes a spot that is not nearly as beneficial for them as it would be for you, right? And I think what they might be doing, and maybe consciously they might be doing the calculations, maybe not, but they're trying to figure out what the if it's a game that has, you know, like victory points, they're gonna try to figure out what the victory point delta is gonna be. You know, so if I take that, you know, maybe I'm only gonna get like a point out of that, but you know, this other player would have got like 15 points out of there. So I mean, that's a 14 point delta. That's actually better for me. Instead of me taking this other spot where I'm going to get 8 points and this player is getting 14 or 15 points, And, you know, that's only a, you know, it's only a 7-point, you know, swing there. So I don't know, like the hate drafting thing or, you know, taking a spot in a worker placement game. Like I still see that as part of that, you know, magic circle, you know, social contract of the game. But I could totally see where someone wouldn't, you know, they just wouldn't be looking at it from that viewpoint, and they would think you only did that, you know, as our good buddy Linus likes to say, you know, that was a direct attack. You know, even though it's, you know, not at all. I think this particular question leads into mechanisms very cleanly. And there's a couple of mechanisms that I want to talk about, and I think we can dive a little bit deeper into. So, for example, trading. So if you have trading in a game, say something like Bonanza. You know, Bonanza, I love Bonanza. I think it's a great game. I think most people who like trading games enjoy Bonanza. Of course, you know, no game is for everyone. But I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I've never actually read the rules. I've only been taught. But I don't think there's any restrictions on how you can trade, right? Other than, like, you can't trade something planted. Okay.
There are a few.
Yeah?
So you can only trade... Yeah, so you can't trade something that's been planted.
Mm-hmm.
You can only trade with the active player.
Right, the active player is the one that is going to be doing the trading with other players, right?
Right. And there's a one that people kind of commonly miss and that makes the game even more shenanigans-y than ever before, which is that once the active player resolves a trade, they have to plant what they got right away. It doesn't go into their bin.
Right.
So they can't trade it with someone and then trade that to somebody else.
Right, right.
Which I've played a number of times by that wrong rule, and that explodes the game, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's still fun, but you end up with some deals that are absurd.
Right. But that's it for, like, kind of restrictions, right? As far as we're aware.
I think so. There's not, like, a structure, right? You can make as many offers as you want. You can hang out on your turn for an indeterminate amount of time waiting for someone to take the red bean that you can't plant from in front of you.
There's also the promise of future trades later on.
Ew.
Right. And like yeah, I don't think you have to trade like one bean for another. I think technically you could just like you can just give someone a bean and they give you nothing.
Things, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So yeah,
absolutely.
So like and I just looked it up on BGG. It currently has a rating of like 7.1. Its overall rank is 318 out of, you know, 80,000 games. So that's pretty good. And it's been around for a long time, and
it's okay.
that's better than most of us are going to do. We'll put it that way. And so you know, and like I said, I love this game, but it seems like you can have a lot of degenerate things happen in this game because of the trading structure, right? So, like Drew, like you said, like if I have a red bean in front of me, I'm like, all right, guys. My turn's not over until someone takes this. You know, like you could do that, right? Now everyone at the table's gonna hate you. But there's nothing in the game.
I've never had anyone do it so explicitly as that. But that's definitely been the implication a number of times where a player's just kinda like, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. Take this red bean, come on. And they just sit there and kind of bother people over it for forever.
Right. Yeah, so there's nothing, you know, there's nothing in the game that's going to restrict those degenerative things. So it seems like it's very much up to the players when they're playing that game to either not do it or to kind of police, you know, the table.
They have to, like, institute a rule, sort of. Like, the group consensus says your turn is over. Even though that's not in the rule book anywhere, we've decided that
right.
We'll not get rid of that red bean, so plant it and move on.
Right, right. Yeah, either plant it or, you know, you're just out of the game. Yeah, so yeah. I'm wondering, is that a problem with this design? You know, with just the potential to have those kind of degenerative things happen in the game? And if it is... Is it something that, you know, Uwe should have tried to resolve? I don't know. What do you think, Drew?
So, problem is a harsh word.
Sure, it is. Yeah.
So this is one of the things that really got me interested in this, because those types of situations in Bonanza absolutely make it a more sort of dynamic and a game that you'll want to tell stories about after you play it. Those might not always be positive, but often they are, right? Like, you ganged up with somebody to not take some really great trade, but to, you know, switch and take an awful trade from you so it doesn't benefit that person, and different things like that, right? But if it's not a problem, then there have been efforts to fix the not problem, like Vladislav Vodl's game Greenland with a cool letter in the middle, which is sort of his take on Catan, where the way that trading works is on your turn, you offer one trade, and if that person doesn't accept it, that's your trade. And they can't talk about it before. Like, it's really regimented the way the rules set that up. You make that offer, they take it or don't, and that's it. So, I don't know. Like, there have been efforts to fix it, and they work interestingly, although maybe they make the game maybe less dynamic along that axis.
So I haven't played Greenland, but how would you compare that to Catan? Do you think it's like a quote unquote better design, or do you think it just does trading better? Maybe it's not an overall better game. I don't know. What do you think?
I like it more, but it's certainly harder to play. I don't think it's a better game specifically for that reason. Like, I'm not sure if it's harder to play just because of familiarity or if it's actually significantly more complex, but the trading mechanism is at least certainly interesting, and it keeps it moving a little bit more briskly than Catan can if you have the type of player that's going to fish around for a bunch of trades on their turn. But then again, I've played Catan with a group where it just goes super fast.
So. Yeah. All right. So, Daniel, what do you think? So in a game like Bonanza, where, you know, there's nothing to restrict kind of degenerative game outcomes due to the trading, do you think, you know, is that like an issue with the design that the, you know, Uwe maybe tried to sort of figure out what to do about? Or do you think it's something that, you know, it's not Uwe's issue, it's more on the players? What do you think?
I think now, if you're designing a game with open trading like this, you have to look at the history of games with open trading and learn from those systems and see where they've fallen, perhaps, or where they've gone out of favor for various reasons. When those games were designed, there weren't that many open trading games. I think you can probably go back to Pit, right, as the ultimate example of an open trading game. And that's just total chaos. There's just madness going on in that game. But I think I can't fault the designer for designing a game in the way they did at the time that they did, because everyone's trying to make the best game they possibly could, and certainly Bonanza has held up over time. I certainly enjoy playing it still, regardless of any possible weirdness that you could have in the trading.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there needs to be necessarily, you don't need to add a stock exchange regulation system expansion to Bonanza to make sure that these weird shenanigans on Wall Street don't happen. Like, there's a certain point where the spirit of the game, I guess we're coming back to this topic again, the spirit of the game and the presentation of the game is light and fun. And if you're going into that thing expecting a hardcore Wall Street simulator where you're taking every single edge you can possibly get, to a certain extent, that is not the experience that was promised by that game. And if you're trying to make it that way, then it's not really doing it.
All right. If you were going to design a trading game today, would you have open trading?
No.
No?
No. Mm. Partly because it's been done. Like, not necessarily because I find fault in it or that I don't think I could design a cool game around it. But I think a number of games have done it, and I want to explore a different design space. So that's really the primary reason why I wouldn't do an open trading game today, necessarily.
How about you, Drew? Would you open trading, or would, if you were going to have trading, would you have some type of controls around it?
I would definitely put some controls around it, but I think the primary motivation would be to do something cute and clever rather than to restrict the players as much. I honestly was really enamored of the idea in Greenland of making only one offer and that being it. Because I think thematically it works really well. In that game, you're like a Viking chief. You're like, no, this is the deal. Take it or leave it, right? And that's pretty cool. So it serves a mechanical purpose, but it's also just kind of unique and clever and fits with the theme of the game. So I'd hope to be able to do something that's as integrated with the rest of the system as that is.
So I don't know. Do we have a consensus on you know, kind of preserving the magic circle or preventing, you know, against the spirit of play? Thing, you know, do we feel more designer, more players? What do you think, Drew?
Nope. I don't think we have a consensus.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
It's always going to come down to subjectivity, I think, in this particular case. Like, regardless of what... there, especially now, with so much direct contact between creators and the players, it's really hard to say who's ultimately responsible for a lot of these issues.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting factor that I hadn't thought about. Yeah, the ease of contacting, you know, the designer in a lot of cases, getting like a on the fly ruling on Twitter or something like that. Yeah, I think this one is a lot going to, like you said, it's going to depend a lot on kind of the person that is looking at the at the question or the specific design. I do think, at least from my own preferences and from my own designs, I do try to build something in to avoid really, really degenerative things. Like, for example, Split the Loot that I've been working on for a while. I am trying to have something in there that you can't just leave one player completely out of the negotiations for the loot every round and just never give them anything. Because I think if you would put out a game, you know, a negotiation game today that you have the potential of just, oh, that player, you know, Mike over there, he's a jerk, we're just going to keep him out, you know, for this game. Don't give him anything. Like, if that would be possible, boy, I just don't think that would go over very well, even for people that like negotiation and things like that. But that might just be me. But I think I would definitely try to rein in those kind of, you know, really negative, degenerate things that could happen in the design.
Sure. I mean, and to me, like, that example seems like a primarily group-dependent example, right? Like, if you're playing with a group that's going to single out one player and destroy them, either the group needs to know that that's how they play games. Like, if you're familiar with everybody at the table, maybe it's okay. But a lot of games get played once, I guess, nowadays. So we...
yeah.
And maybe at cons.
I feel bad because I was that jerk in one game of Bang. it was, but here's the thing: in Bang, here's a conflict between the social dynamic and the game itself. In Bang, there is a completely utilitarian choice to just gang up on the person who's already been hit. As soon as you just do that, everybody pile on the person who's already weakest. That eliminates one bit of range so that you can actually target the people who you intend to target. It removes a variable of someone who can hurt you. There's all the reason in the world to be a pack of hyenas and just pounce on whoever is the weakest person just by completely arbitrary happenstance that they happen to be the one who has the lowest hit points at that particular time. But the social dynamic of that is awful. It eliminates a player who's getting beat up on, and it's entirely by chance. They have hurt feelings. You feel bad because you're the one who's the jerk in that situation. And so there's not but your own empathy keeping you from making this otherwise completely reasonable and logical choice in game.
So don't play that with psychopaths is what you're saying.
What? I don't think that's the takeaway from that, Matt.
Well... I'm sorry,
so
you're
would
right.
You say that's
sociopaths.
The game,
right.
Or the... Yeah. Matthew. so, would you say that's the game or your fault, Daniel? The game basically not forced you, but that's the right way to play Bang, right? Like, that's better for all the reasons you listed.
It is, and it's one of those things where two aspects of the magic circle were in conflict with each other. One aspect that we all agreed on was that we're going to play this game and that we're going to go for the win. We are... Winning is the goal of the game. That's why we're doing this activity. But the other part of the magic circle was that we're all trying to have fun. This is the one night of the week that we all get together and play a game, and we're all trying to entertain each other to some extent. Doing one thing conflicted with the other, and in this particular situation where I happened to be in that particular game, they were mutually exclusive, and I made the wrong call, to be honest. I can set aside this game and lose it and make the suboptimal choice, but I can't repair a friendship. I can't rejoin a group or ease hurt feelings as easily as I could just toss a game and lose that game because I didn't make the optimal choice in that regard. And I feel like there are important things that happen at the game table that are unrelated to the game or the mechanics itself that the players are responsible for ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
That got heavy there for a second.
No,
sorry.
No, that was profound. I wanted to let it breathe for a second there. All right, so the last question, and Daniel, I'm going to go to you first in case you need to drop off before the end of the recording here, is who is more responsible for preventing quarterbacking an alpha player in a co-op game? Is this more on the designer, or is this more on the group? What do you think, Daniel?
I'm gonna lay this on the designer. I'll toss this to the designer. There are mechanisms now, since the advent of many, many co-op games, that can be used and implemented to prevent the alpha player quarterbacking behavior. Whether those methods and those techniques have had success depends possibly on your group. Some players are going to be so intent on controlling every aspect of the game, again, because they have emphasized or valued the goal of winning over the experience of the other players. And in that pursuit, they will use any means available to assure victory because, hey, that's why we're playing, right? We want to win, and winning is great. Even if you're steamrolling over everyone else's choices, you can prevent that. You can put guardrails against that. But some players, they are still driving that steamroller, and they're going to be pushing against those guardrails as hard as they can. You can't work around the jerks. You can't design around jerks. Like, jerks are going to exist, but at the same time, you can't throw up your hands and say, I'm not going to take any steps or any measures at all to prevent this behavior. Like, you are accepting responsibility. You're making a product. You need to at least put some effort into watching out for these behaviors and designing around them.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting, and I would largely agree. Now, how do you feel about both Matt Leacock, you know, famous for Pandemic, and John Gilmore, famous for Dead of Winter, both feel that it is a group problem and not a designer problem? I don't know how, you know, if you said that to them, they respond back to you and say, no, it's group. I don't know. How would you respond to that?
With Dead of Winter, I think they've done a clever thing. And I don't think they've thrown out their hands as much as I don't know what interviews or what statements they've made to the effect of how they designed around this behavior. But I played the game and I played Dead of Winter. And I think the clever thing they did was throw in the potential of a traitor in that game so that If someone's really being pushy and really pushing and shoving and elbowing people out of the way, immediately they're drawing suspicion to themselves and run the risk of being exiled from the group. And no one wants that. That's awful. And so they've put in some threat there for being a quarterback. In Pandemic, I have heard Leacock say that he just doesn't worry about it. And I mean, to each designer their own. I certainly still enjoy Pandemic, and I certainly don't like it when people quarterback, and they're honestly, except for some hidden information and some other things that you could do, there isn't much you can do about it in that game. You just have to come into it accepting, and I have explicitly said this when I play a Pandemic game with other players, I have to explicitly say, we are not going to quarterback. We are going to let people make the decisions they want to make. No cringing, no wincing, no sighs or calls of doubt. You can discuss, you can debate, but you gotta be on your best behavior when you're playing this game together, because ultimately we have to live with each other after this game.
Well, not if the diseases win.
Well, that's fair. That's fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. That's a thing. And to fit the theme of the game, if we win, we still have to live with each other.
Yeah, I think Dead of Winter does another really cool thing, which is gives you these potentially mutually exclusive personal win conditions, right? So maybe I need to get a bunch of tools, and maybe you also want to get some of them, and there's a reason that I would want it and not you. And that's pretty interesting as well, but I don't know. In general, Josh tweeted at me shortly before we started talking about this that cooperative game shouldn't be a solo game. And I think that really kind of sums up the not that it shouldn't have a solo mode, but that there should be a difference between if I'm playing a co-op game with a group of people and I'm playing a solo game with like an audience, I guess there should be a really meaningful difference between those things. And I think you can enforce it by doing what Daniel described, but I don't know, with recent co-op games, designers are able to pull those levers a little bit, try to put some reins on those types of things. A really good example is the kind of difference between Castle Panic, which I thought was completely possible to kind of quarterback and play solo, and then Star Trek Panic, which has a bunch of weird stuff happening between everybody's turns, so you can't do it as easily. You can talk and debate, but you can't just tell somebody what they're going to do on their turn.
I haven't played Star Trek Panic yet. I would like to, because I sort of like Castle Panic. Like, it's okay. And I know they made a bunch of changes, and I like Star Trek, so I would definitely play it. So it sounds like, Drew, you're on the designer side of the fence on this one, that they should do whatever they can. Yeah. So I think the only defense that I've heard, and I believe that Matt Leacock said this, was that in some groups, you actually have players who want someone to take charge. And they want to be part of a team, but they don't want to be making decisions themselves. They want someone else to kind of guide them and essentially to be that alpha player. I think that is valid, right? Because, you know, if the group has decided that if we're playing and Drew is he's our Dugan in the game, and, you know, we're going to defer to Drew if there's some type of disagreement, you know, if as a group we did that, okay, you know, that's okay for us. And if the co-op was actively working against that of not allowing, you know, to have an alpha, that particular group would not enjoy it quite as much. I don't know that that's enough to allow a designer to just say, no, I'm going to throw up my hands and not worry about it. But I can see that argument. But so yeah, that, as someone who's guilty of, being the alpha player, sometimes in co-ops, I actually would prefer, co-ops to not, allow that, as much. I haven't tried designing a co-op game, so I haven't run into this myself, but if I was, yeah, I would try to, have some type of constraints in there to try to minimize that. So, I think we're going to end the discussion at that point. There's a lot more that we could talk about with this topic, and we might revisit this at a later date. But I think that was a lot of good stuff already, and we don't want to make this a two-hour-long episode. Let's move into our news segment here. Daniel, you have something that you would like to talk about a little bit more, perhaps, than you did at the beginning of the episode.
Yes, I am releasing Curse You Robin Hood at some point this month. Depending on when you're listening, it could be out already. It could be just pretty close to being out. Self-publishing it on Drive-Thru Cards. Look for it. Curse You Robin Hood, you are merchants in Sherwood Forest trying to get rich, but not so rich that you become a target for Robin Hood and his merry men. The idea of it is a very raucous trading game, as we've been discussing. Hey, that worked out. And it has a very interesting trading, layers of trading that will occur. And then if you're lucky enough, maybe you make it to the market and actually get something you really want. Ultimately, in the end, you're playing against the other players, and you're also playing against virtual opponents that are characters from the Robin Hood stories. It's a fun game, really great for pub-style play for players. Three to six players is probably the best experience. You can play with two players, but you have to play with some virtual opponents, which is, they're still fun. And some players have even played with single player with entirely virtual opponents on their table, and they've still had fun there too. But look for it. Curse You Robin Hood. Yeah.
Do you know what you're going to have it on Drive-Thru Cards for? At what price?
I am aiming to keep it under $9.99. It'll be my first Drive-Thru Cards product that has a tuck box, and how that factors into the pricing is still a little variable. But I'm, as with most of my products, I'm trying to keep it under $9.99. The game features artwork from Molly Ostertag, who is the artist behind Strong Female Protagonist, and all of her art is fantastic. Check it out, Curse You Robin Hood.
Yeah, the cover is on Board Game Geek. It's great. Daniel, if people want to get in contact with you, where can they do that?
You can find my blog at danielsolis.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Daniel Solis. That's DanielSolis.
And Drew, where can people get in touch with you so they can argue with you about alpha games?
Oh, please do. You can find me on Twitter at EvenWeirderMove. And I've got a blog at anEvenWeirderMove.wordpress.com.
And as always, you can get in touch with me on Twitter at Matt Wolf with an E on the end of Wolf. And the same username on BoardGameGeek if you prefer that way. And I think there's a lot more to talk about with this episode. And as I said, we're going to try to do a part two at some point in the future. But in the meantime, if you go to our guild on BoardGameGeek, you can just discuss this with us and tell us where we're wrong or where you agree with us. You go to podcast.gdevnc.com, and that'll take you straight to our guild. And you can also follow the group on Twitter at GD of NC, which of course stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. And we would love some reviews in iTunes, if you would be so kind. And there's no points awarded, but it would just be really cool if people to do that. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Remember not to play any games with Cheaty McCheaterface, and we will see you next time.
Please play responsibly.